we're going to start by thinking about one of the accusations that is sometimes levelled against Christians, and that is that Christians are a little bit out of touch with reality. And to be honest, we're sometimes guilty of this ourselves, because we even in our minds start to think about a kind of almost like a spiritual standard, but in the real world we do things a little bit differently. Okay? And, you know, this is something that the world sees in us. The Welsh poet Marian Ames describes the chapel-goers as being so heavenward-focused they were of no earthly use. And that is the way the world sees us. But before we look at some of the things that Jesus says about this and some of the stories that help us understand it, I wanted to start off by asking you to challenge what reality even is. So bear with me, if you will, for a second. What I'd like you to do is just turn your head left to right and back again, but focus in on the sensation of your collar rubbing on the back of your neck. Wow, isn't that interesting? Now tell me honestly, how many times have you turned your head this morning, particularly if you drove here, and you didn't notice the fact that there's a very distinct sensation of your collar rubbing on the back of your neck? Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the same thing would apply another way. While we're sitting here, it's pretty quiet. We can't hear a lot of traffic noise. But imagine if we were waiting for someone to arrive and we were listening for an engine sound, and all of a sudden we'd start hearing traffic noise, wouldn't we? You see, the thing is this. When you take all of our senses into account, our senses can gather far more data than our brains can possibly process. This constant tactile stimulation all over our skin, the ends of hairs, temperature, pressure, feeling of a wedding ring, feeling of a watch. But our brain is so cleverly devised by chance, by God, that it has the ability to filter out and make into sort of background noise all of that stimulation we can't do anything with. Because if it didn't, we'd be so overloaded with stimulation and information and data processing all the time, we'd never actually be able to function on a sort of, you know, a cognitive level. Now here's the question. If most of the data that we take in, we are in fact ignoring, then what if the rest of that data were telling us a different story to the one we actually construct for ourselves in our minds? Mm-hmm. And that realization is the simple reason why it is that two people, a Christian and an atheist, can go through an identical experience, and the Christian can see God's hand throughout it, and the atheist cannot. Same data, same input, same senses, same sounds, same smells, same experiences, but one of us perceives a reality of God being there, and the other one perceives a reality of no God being there. And so I want you to consider this morning that there are two different realities. There's God's reality and our reality. And the question at each point is which one we choose to live in. So we're going to look at some stories. We'll start off with the story in Mark 5 and verse 21. So a very well-known story. We'll just read it fairly quickly, or pick the main points out of it. Setting the scene, verse 21, when Jesus went back across to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him on the shore. A leader of the local synagogue, whose name was Jairus, came and fell down before him, pleading with him to heal his little daughter. She's about to die, he said in desperation. Please come and place your hands on her. Heal her so she can live. Okay, now we know the story. We don't need to read the rest of the chapter. We know that Jesus said, yes, of course he would. He set out on his way. But there's a huge crowd, and crowds move slowly. And then there were interruptions along the way. A woman who needed to be healed, and she interrupted things, and there's all this dialogue with her. Anyway, this process takes so long that before Jesus can get to the house, a messenger comes to him saying, don't bother, it's too late, she's dead. And just to give you an idea of how long a time has elapsed, by the time that they all arrive at the home of the synagogue ruler, not only is the little girl dead, but she has been dead so long that a huge crowd of mourners has gathered. So the aunties and uncles from the next village are there. And there's some musicians setting up in the corner. and the old ladies from church are laying out cucumber sandwiches. You know, the whole thing's in swing. This is, at best, many hours, but maybe best part of a day in between the message getting to Jesus and Jesus getting to the place where the little girl is lying dead. Okay, so verse 36, Jesus ignored their comments and said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just trust me." Okay. Then he went into the little girl's room, this is verse 41, holding her hand, he said to her, "Get up, little girl." And the girl, who was 12 years old, immediately stood up and walked around. Her parents were absolutely overwhelmed. You see, it's interesting, isn't it? Whatever else happens in our lives, we would think of death as being the end. And so everything we do is framed within a timeline that ends with death, because you can't go on after that. So when we think about preparing for our retirement, we work backwards from the probable age of our death. And we say, well, I want to enjoy at least 70 years of retirement, so we invest or we save or we pay into a pension in order that, but we've worked back on our timeline. Or if we think about paying off the mortgage, you know, we've got to have it paid off by, because then we can retire, and then so long further down the timeline before we die. We work all these kind of things out. But what's interesting in the story is that Jesus' description of death is that it's no more than falling asleep in the evening, knowing you wake up in the morning. And I can't help pointing out, as parents of teenagers, that Jesus has less trouble waking up a dead girl than most parents have getting their teenage kids out of bed after a normal night's sleep. Right? So clearly, in God's reality, death is not the end any more than lying down to sleep is the end of our lives. And that's a sobering thought, isn't it? Because we always frame things in that, and never more so than when we make our prayers and petitions to God. If someone's unwell, if someone's sick, what do we pray? Please heal this person. Please work a miracle. Please. And in our minds, we're setting a timeline on that, saying, before they die, because when they die, it's too late. But over and over again, the stories in the Bible tell us, whether we're talking about the eventual resurrection or even a much more short-term resurrection like this, the stories in the Bible remind us that death isn't the end. The question is, in which of those two realities are we going to live? A reality that times everything against 70 years, 80 years, or a reality that says, I'm thinking about eternity. I don't need to achieve this level of promotion, this level of wealth, this level of whatever in this life, because I have eternity. I don't need to get the big house now, because Jesus said, in my Father's house are many mansions, and so on. All right. So let's look at another story. Go over to the Gospel of John. John chapter 2, Jesus' first miracle, though I wonder whether it is Jesus' first miracle. It's certainly his first public miracle. I just question whether it is the first time he's ever done anything remarkable, because clearly Mary had no trouble at all knowing that Jesus would be able to fix the problem. So maybe as a family they had already experienced something. We don't know, just speculating. Okay, it's the story of the wedding feast. We know it well enough that I don't think I need to go through it. Basically, Jesus and his disciples and his mother were at this wedding, and they ran out of wine. And you can just imagine the shame in a small village. 50 years from now, you know, this young couple, will, old couple by the stage, will bump into someone in the street. "Don't I know you? Oh yes, you're the one whose wedding ran out of wine." You can imagine how it would go in a small village. So this is a bit of a big deal. But Jesus' mother went to Jesus and said, you know, something needs to be done about it. And she told the servants to do whatever he told them to do. Verse 6, six stone water pots were standing there. They were used for Jewish ceremonial purposes and held 20 to 30 gallons each. Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." When the jars had been filled to the brim, he said, "Dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies." So they followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water, that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, he called the bridegroom and said, "Usually a host serves the best wine first. Then when everyone's full and doesn't care, he brings out the less expensive wines, but you have kept the best until now." So it's the miracle of turning water into wine. Except that, as C.S. Lewis points out, that's not really a miracle at all, because it happens all the time. not so much in this country, but anywhere that's a bit warmer, all across the globe, at this moment in time, hundreds of thousands of litres of water is getting turned into, well, grapes, without us doing anything. That's what a grapevine does. It takes water from the soil, sun, nutrients, it turns water into wine all of the time. And the clever bit is, unless you've sprayed your grapes with really nasty chemicals, they even come pre-populated with exactly the right strain of yeast to produce good wine, as opposed to vinegar, if you simply crush them and let them get on with it. The miracle is that if you let your grapevine do the work for you, it's going to take 6 months to fruit, another 6 months to ferment, and probably several years after that to mature before the master of the ceremonies would say, oh, you've kept the best wine till last. And Jesus took 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 15 years, and made it happen like that. And so the reality isn't so much, of course it is, that Jesus turned water into wine, but the reality of this, or the miracle of this, is that Jesus did what God does and stepped outside of time to make something happen that would normally take a long time and to make it happen more or less instantly. And that should hardly surprise us, because one of the things we're told about God, if you keep your finger there in the Gospels and just flick back to Psalm 90, I think we're probably all aware of this, but this is the passage which says, Psalm 90, verse 1 and 2, Lord, through all the generations, you have been our home. Before the mountains were created, before you made the earth and the world, you are God without beginning or end. It's really difficult to draw a timeline that doesn't have a beginning and doesn't have an end. And so we get this concept about God, that God exists outside of time. And that's reiterated over in 2 Peter chapter 3. I just want to draw your attention to something remarkable about this statement. Chapter 3 and verse 8, which says this. When I find 2 Peter, sorry. Chapter 3 and verse 8. You must not forget, dear friends, that with the Lord, a day is like a thousand years, and a thousand years is like a day. And I find it really interesting that Peter describes both eventualities. Because even as humans, when you get older, time doesn't seem to take very long to pass, does it? You look back and you think that happened last month, and then you look in the calendar and realise it was 3 years ago. So if he had just said, a thousand years is like a day, it seems like a day, but actually it was a thousand years. All he'd be describing was that God was really, really old. But he also describes it happening the other way around. That time not only goes so quickly, it seems that a day is like a thousand years, but sometimes it goes so slowly that a thousand years is like a day. And you think, okay, so time just doesn't mean anything to God in the same way it does to us, which is kind of borne out with our first miracle, stepping past death and continuing with life. And it's certainly borne out by the second miracle in which Jesus just bypasses time. But let's look at one more miracle. And we're going over to Matthew chapter 14 to find this one. Again, a very well-known story, which is also recorded in John 6:16, with an interesting difference, which I will mention in a minute. It's the story of where Jesus ends up walking on water. Matthew describes it as saying this, immediately after this, Jesus made the disciples get back into the boat to cross to the other side of the lake. But John says it was getting dark and the disciples were panicking. And they were in a rush to get on the boat. And he describes it as entirely being their business. They were quick to get away. Oh, got to get on the boat. So anyway, afterwards, back in Matthew's account, afterwards, Jesus went up into the hills by himself to pray. Night fell while he was there alone. Meanwhile, the disciples were in trouble far away from the land, for a strong wind had risen and they were fighting heavy waves. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came to them walking on the water. Okay, let's just unpack this for a minute. What time do you think dusk was in the Middle East? Okay. possibly a little bit later, let's say it was around 7 or something. So John describes them as being keen to get away because darkness is falling. So this is dusk, so around about 7 o'clock. They're still rowing that boat at 3 o'clock in the morning. Count the hours. 8 hours. Yeah. Now here's the astonishing bit about this. The Lake of Galilee is only about 6 miles wide. And John's account says that they were in the midst of the sea. In other words, they were about halfway across. After 8 hours of rowing, they'd travelled 3 miles. Right? Now, I don't know how fast those apes and so on go up and down the River Severn, but I'm going to guess they can probably do about 20 miles an hour, maybe. Even if it's 12 miles an hour, we're talking about a half hour, quarter of an hour's worth of rowing. Obviously, a fishing boat isn't quite as quick as that, but you've got 12 big, strong men rowing this boat. You'd expect it to make reasonable progress. 3 miles in 8 hours. And you have to ask the question, why on earth were they still rowing at all? Why haven't they just given up? Well, think about it. They didn't have Edmondo on their phone. They couldn't pull up the GPS and know where they were. They're in the middle of a dark lake with no lights around anywhere. There were no street lights on the shore. There was nothing to see. As far as they knew, they might have been one more pull on those oars away from hearing the keel crunch onto the gravel of the shore. And in any case, isn't this what human beings do? We stick out things. We stay in the job we should have quit a long time ago. Because we know what we're doing, and we just keep on doing it. They knew what they were doing, rowing a boat. They were good at it, and they kept on doing it. We stay in relationships that maybe we should have kissed goodbye to a long time ago. Because we're doing what we know we can do, and so we stick with it. I could give many other examples, but that does tend to be the human condition. We don't want to change. We don't want to be seen to give up on things, so we stick out things. And so the disciples stuck at it for 8 hours of rowing against the waves and the wind. I don't care how fit they were, how strong they were, they must have been exhausted by the time they got to 3 o'clock in the morning. But here's the really staggering bit about this story. It starts with two groups of people, Jesus and the disciples, together in the same place at the same time on the shore of the lake. And it ends with those same two groups of people, the disciples and Jesus, together in the same place on the boat in the middle of the lake. But think about the different realities those two groups of people experienced in between. One spent those 8 hours straining, stressing, worried, perhaps a little bit frightened, probably getting to the point of arguing with one another, short-tempered, fed up, exhausted. The other probably spent 7 of those hours praying and then took a gentle stroll 3 miles out across the surface of the water. Started in the same place, they ended in the same place. But what a difference in between the human reality of straining and struggling and God's reality, where Jesus put everything in the hands of his Father and then used his Father's power to solve the problem. Now you say, well, hang on a second, that's all very well, but we can't walk on water. No. But then technically we're not being asked to row across a lake either. So the whole thing just becomes an analogy, an illustration of the difference, the way things that can work when you look at the difference between human reality and God's reality. Let me give you an example of this. When we're young and we're starting out in life, and sometimes even when we're older, we get to that state where, as Dave Ramsey so wonderfully puts it, there's too much month left at the end of the money. Ever had that experience? Mm-hmm. And so we do what we can in our human strength. We take on overtime at work, we take on another job, we work hard, we keep on pulling on those oars, doing what we know we can do, straining away at it. And then comes the temptation. I could work on Sabbath, be another day's work. I can get some more money in. I can get closer to my goal of reaching the other side of the lake. Or this tithing thing. I'm not sure I even believe in it anyway, so maybe I won't put anything in the offering plate this month, because we're a bit short. Given to charity? No, I'll do that later, I'll put that off. And so we try to solve the problem in our own strength, just like the disciples were doing. They could do it, they could work harder. If we just row that bit harder, we'll get there. We'll get there eventually. Or we could listen to Jesus, who said, Give no thought for tomorrow, saying, what will we eat? Or what will we wear? Your Heavenly Father knows that you need all these things, but rather seek first the kingdom of heaven. And so we're confronted again by the difference between our human reality and God's reality. It should be clear, there are enough stories in the Bible we could find. I've just picked three, I could have picked 30. But of course the challenge is simply this. If anyone had come to those disciples whilst they're in that middle of that 8 hours of rowing and said, guys, you're wasting your time, you're not getting anywhere, why don't you just stop what you're doing and put the thing in God's hands, what do you think their answer would have been? We can't stop rowing. Look, the wind will blow us off course. Oh, we can't stop rowing. The waves will turn the boat around. Oh, we can't. But of course they could have, couldn't they? Because look what happened when Jesus turned up. One word, and that was the end of the story. And the same can be true in our lives if we accept God's reality, and if we engage with his reality, and if we choose to live by faith.